I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Same-sex couples from across the country will have the right to marry in California starting next week. Some gay activists are celebrating. Others are asking, is that necessarily a good thing? But first, federal health experts are now saying the salmonella outbreak linked to some raw tomatoes has sickened 167 people in 17 states. McDonald's has stopped serving sliced tomatoes. Burger King, Outback Steakhouse, Taco Bell, KFC have all stopped serving several varieties. While Walmart, Winn-Dixie Stores, and Kroger Company, the largest U.S. grocery chain, are among stores pulling certain tomatoes off the shelves as the Food and Drug Administration investigates the source of the contamination. Well, joining us is Julie Jargon. She's covering the story from Chicago for The Wall Street Journal. And Julie, let's be clear. Which types of tomatoes are being investigated and which ones are considered safe?
The ones that the FDA is recommending people avoid are raw red plum tomatoes, Roma tomatoes, and round tomatoes, which I think can encompass a lot of different varieties.
Right.
And the ones that they are saying are probably not associated with the salmonella outbreak are cherry tomatoes, grape tomatoes, and any tomatoes that people grow in their own backyards.
Okay, so the red plum are more like a pear-shaped, and the Roma are more like a blimp look, where the cherry tomato are the small round ones.
Exactly, and also the FDA is saying that tomatoes that are still on the vine, that those are supposed to be okay as well.
Besides avoiding certain varieties, how can consumers make better choices about what tomatoes they buy? Because your newspaper has a list of the states that produce tomatoes that aren't affected by this bacteria, but how do you know where your tomatoes come from?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, sometimes produce will have a sticker saying the country of origin, but not necessarily the state where a vegetable or fruit is grown. Well, so I don't think the general consumer will necessarily know whether a tomato that they're buying comes from North Carolina or Florida. The grocery stores and the restaurants are going to have to get that information from their suppliers.
Well, you quote the leader of a Florida tomato growers cooperative who says the movement of tomatoes in this country has come to a halt. This could have a huge financial impact.
It could, and that organization that I quoted, they represent 90% of the tomatoes grown in Florida, and Florida is the nation's top producer of fresh tomatoes, and that organization is estimating that they have about $40 million worth of tomatoes on the market right now.
And tomatoes from Florida have not been cleared.
That's correct, and they're at the end of their harvesting season, but other states are going to, you know, start harvesting their tomatoes right now. And so if consumers stop buying tomatoes and these retail chains and restaurants stop selling them, that could have even broader impact on the rest of the tomato industry.
Well, and you write that if history is any lesson for us, people might stop buying it. You write that after spinach was contaminated with E. coli bacteria in 2006, consumers didn't go back to spinach for months. And you quote from a survey that just came out Monday from Deloitte LLP that says 50% of Americans have stopped eating some kind of food because of a recall, and 9 out of 10 want more local food. Do you see this as being another scare that, you know, passes from the headlines, or do you see this as having more of an impact?
Well, it could have more of an impact, and I think part of that is going to depend on how quickly the FDA is able to pinpoint the source of this outbreak. If they are able to quickly determine that it's a localized, sort of isolated incident, and they can quickly work to resolve that and take any bad tomatoes out of production, then maybe it won't have long-lasting effects. There were studies done after the spinach recall of a couple of years ago, well after, you know, the recall was over. Consumers who were surveyed were still saying that they didn't either realize that the recall was over, or if they had, they still weren't purchasing spinach and other leafy greens because they were still afraid that maybe it wasn't safe.
And have tomatoes from Mexico been cleared, or is there still a possibility that these might be tomatoes that came from outside the country?
It is possible that these are tomatoes that could have come from outside of the country. The FDA has listed a number of places that they say have, you know, the outbreak has not been linked to, and they've listed a few countries that are sort of in the clear, including Canada and Guatemala. But there are all sorts of other countries, including Mexico, that haven't yet been added to any sort of cleared list.
Yeah. That's Julie Jargon. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Julie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, starting next week, gay and lesbian couples will be able to legally get married in California. Not just California couples, but couples from across the country. Massachusetts was the first state to allow same-sex marriage, but that right here isn't extended to couples from out of state. So California's Supreme Court decision clearing the way for next week's weddings is a big victory for same-sex marriage activists. But it's also led to an interesting debate in the blogosphere. Will the gay rights movement reach endgame by achieving this holy grail of equality, and maybe leave other goals in limbo? Our guests write about gay and lesbian issues in the blogosphere. Scott Schmidt is a political columnist and a contributor to SpotOn.com. Scott, welcome.
Thank you.
And Miriam Perez is a reproductive justice activist and an editor at Feministing.com and RadicalDoula.com. She's in Washington, D.C. Miriam, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Hi.
I understand neither of you is married. Start with you, Miriam. Just your overarching thought about the California ruling and same-sex marriage.
Well, I'm definitely supportive of the ruling, and I think it does signify, you know, a good step forward for people in California. But I don't think that marriage is the cure-all for the issues that are important to me when it comes to the GLBT community, the queer community. And I think there are a lot of issues that are important that aren't going to be solved by marriage.
And when you say GLBT, a gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender,
yes.
And yet would you go further and say, as some have, that in fact maybe the push for same-sex marriage is a problem because it's taking the spotlight off other issues?
Yeah, I definitely think that the movement that's dominated by a push just for marriage has a lot of problems because it's taking a lot of the resources away from a lot of issues that are more important to maybe even more people in the gay and lesbian community.
Such as?
Healthcare, right? So healthcare is not going to be solved for everyone by marriage equality because only people who are married and have jobs that provide partnership benefits will be able to access healthcare through that particular system. Things like violence against people in the LGBT community, problems with homelessness, immigration. I mean, I could go on with lots of different issues that are really important to me and to other people in the queer community that aren't being addressed by marriage equality.
Well, Scott, let's turn to you. You write in your blog that the lack of a model for recognized partnerships created the impression that promiscuity was the norm for the gay community. Do you think that this ruling helps with that issue?
Yeah, I think in many ways it changes the mindsets, especially for those of us who are here in California and, you know, over the next 5 months are going to be seeing our friends get married, going to see our neighbors get married and say, you know, I can do that too, you know, if he's willing to say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the mentality that you're no longer, you know, out there just looking for Mr. Tonight. There's the potentiality of establishing long-term relationships that are recognized by the government.
And you say, in fact, that the fact that the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community didn't have this opportunity to legally marry actually created problems, contributed to the spread of AIDS and other plagues on the community, as you write. Do you think that the fact that marriage wasn't available not only just created the impression of promiscuity, but maybe created some promiscuity?
I think it was a message from the government to gays and lesbians that they were expected not to enter into long-term relationships, and that the government was, you know, sending the message to gays and lesbians to go around, fool around, and do all those things which set the stage for you know, diseases to be spread and you know, everything else. It's not necessarily the causal factor, but it's certainly a message from the government that they did not expect gays and lesbians to have full partnerships and lifelong relationships.
Right.
That's all changed.
What do you think about Miriam's point, though, that the focus on marriage has taken the attention away from other issues?
Well, yeah, I'm going to disagree with her slightly, because I'm in California, and what we've seen over the last 5 years, we've seen a Republican governor sign 19 pieces of pro-gay legislation, a Republican governor who signed more pro-gay legislation than all the other governors of California combined. We've seen a Supreme Court appointed by Pete Wilson and Arnold Schwarzenegger basically allow gay marriage, which to me in California, that was the holy grail. As a Californian, that's really the only right that we had been denied up to this point. And if we can preserve that on the ballot in November in California, it is endgame. We can tell Republican politicians who are thumping their Bible, you know, to get over it, just like they eventually got over women's suffrage, you know, a century ago, and move on.
But do you worry that that in saying that it is endgame, it'll make people think there are no more issues?
Well, you know, and that is certainly that's certainly a risk. What we'll have to do in places like California and Massachusetts is turn around and look at the federal level, because We may be able to get married in California, but that doesn't do anything in terms of getting Social Security benefits, getting tax and immigration status, and all those things that the federal government recognizes. We'll have to turn our attention to Washington, D.C., not Sacramento.
Well, in fact, I want to ask about that. And, Mira, I'm going to get back to you in 1 second. But, Scott, since you're there in California, what is the legality? If a couple, as this new law in California seems to say, if a couple comes from another state and gets married in California, when they go back to their state, do they have the rights that are provided by marriage? Do they have the rights of collecting benefits in their home state?
That depends on you know, a state-by-state basis. Some states, for example, might recognize domestic partnerships but have constitutional amendments that don't recognize marriages. So you're going to have a multi-tiered system where, you know, California's marriages, I believe in New York and Rhode Island and Massachusetts would be recognized, but not necessarily in other states, whereas a domestic partnership from the city of West Hollywood might hold more validity in somewhere like Texas. So, you know, it's going to be a big legal mess to sort out. But getting this far has made that to be the problem, whereas before we were being treated like second-class citizens out here. Right. So, you know, I'm happy to see those kinds of problems arise.
Well, Miriam Perez, first of all, weigh in on anything you've just heard, but I also want to ask you, if I've got your writing right, you are also critical of this push for same-sex marriage because you say it serves, you know, mostly upper-middle-class, white, you know, privileged folks following along on a more conservative mainstream path in the gay community. But doesn't everybody benefit if, as Scott said, there is a perception on the part of middle America that there is a section of the gay and lesbian community that wants to walk that path?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wanted to say first, and in response to Scott's argument about HIV and monogamy, I think that we've learned, you know, from marriage among, you know, heterosexual people, that monogamy and marriage are not mutually exclusive, right? That being in a marriage does not ensure monogamy, nor is marriage a condom. And the biggest groups who are facing increasing HIV/AIDS rates are straight Latina and Black women, and a lot of them are in, you know, monogamous partnerships.
They thought they were monogamous.
They thought they were, right. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that marriage equals monogamy, or that you have to be married to be in a monogamous partnership that includes, you know, safer sex.
Point taken.
But when it comes to the criticism of marriage, I think it's true that, you know, in many ways, it's a very symbolic right. It's a very symbolic move toward equality to say that gay and lesbian people can get married, and that, yes, it benefits people, you know, it benefits everyone. But I don't think that it's the most pressing issue or the issue that's going to benefit the people who are, you know, in most need within the LGBT community. I think that there's issues that are more pressing, and that a lot of the things that Scott's talking about having to do with taxes and inheritance and those benefits are really most important to people at a certain socioeconomic status, at a certain class level, because they're the ones with property that they're worried about inheriting. They're the ones with a job that provides them health care benefits that they could extend to their partner. They're the ones that are worried about, you know, tax benefits. There's a lot of issues that, you know, that people in different socioeconomic statuses within the LGBT community in some ways are more pressing, you know.
That's Miriam Perez. We're also speaking with Scott Schmidt. Both are bloggers joining the debate over same-sex marriage within the gay community. We'll be back with them. And later today, an African chant makes its way to the NBA. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more about gay marriage. Next week, same-sex couples will have the right to marry in California, but voters in California will weigh in on a ballot initiative in November that could redefine marriage as a union between just a man and a woman. Today, though, we're looking at the debate about marriage within the gay community. Now that gays can marry in some places, what's next for the gay rights movement? We're speaking with two activists who write about gay and lesbian matters in the blogosphere. Scott Schmidt is a columnist for SpotOn.com, Miriam Perez, an editor at Feministing.com, and she also blogs at RadicalDoula.com. And Miriam, before the break, you mentioned the socioeconomic divides in the gay community, but I'm wondering if what we're really talking about is maybe a generational divide. We know that you are 24, and, you know, people maybe who tend to worry about benefits are older, have been living longer in relationships, and maybe at 24 you're not seeing marriage or those benefits as important as you would if you were 54.
I mean, I think generational questions definitely take a part in it, but I think it's more than just about what, you know, what kind of job you have or what things you're worried about, but also a shift generationally in the the kind of political agenda of people in the LGBT community. I think we're seeing with people in my generation and younger that there's more of a movement away from traditional kind of ideas of monogamy, different lifestyles, ideas, you know, broadening beyond what it means to have relationships with, you know, one person or multiple people, and reforming that idea, and also just a broader idea of what it means to work for social justice issues. And those, for me, those things really are about putting people, you know, in the most marginalized communities at the center of the work that I'm doing, in the center of my activism. And that means really thinking about, you know, issues having to do with poverty and race and class. And
well, Scott, does she have a point? Yale professor Michael Warner says that focusing on same-sex marriage has made people forget about the importance of AIDS activism. He says gay men in particular have slowed their donations to AIDS organizations, bewitched by a post-gay fantasy world of mortgages, potlucks, and dogs.
Yeah, you know, it does take us away from focusing on all the issues. Like, you know, we haven't talked about Don't Ask, Don't Tell in a while, and yet the military is letting convicted felons into the military, but not gays. We haven't talked about employment non-discrimination on the federal level since last fall, when they tried to cut out transgender people. So certainly, you know, the gay community has a number of agendas, and those agendas go. They weave in both between, you know, conservative values such as marriage and to more liberal values like health care and poverty and all of that. Mm. But at the same time, we're in a situation here in California where, you know, we now have a right that can be taken away. And to say that you can take away rights in America is a dangerous proposition, not only for the LGBT community, but for African Americans, for Latinos, and for others.
So you're saying the community can't let up right now because, in fact, the voters might be ruling on this in a ballot initiative in November. Are you worried about that?
I'm very worried. You know, it's Gay Pride Month, but in some ways I think it's Gay Hubris Month right now, because no one thinks that we're going to lose this thing in November. But, you know, last week there was a fundraiser in West Hollywood for one .org, you know, Bono's anti-poverty group. And that just upset me because, you know, it's people aren't focusing on the fact that we've got the battle of a lifetime out here in California, and it should be our number one priority to defeat this. And then we can work on setting that example, just like the couple, you know, Boston has not fallen into the harbor yet, because gays can get married there. And when the same thing happens in California, and when couples from Kansas and Missouri go to get married in California and come back and show that they can live, you know, live lifestyles that you know, are monogamous and be part of their communities, the people begin to get more accepting of gay and lesbian couples as they see it. And, you know, California can be that shining city on a hill, but only if we beat back this initiative in November.
Miriam, you know, well, I'm sure that Andrew Sullivan, who's the very influential gay conservative voice, his book Virtually Normal, claims that being able to marry will bring gays and lesbians into mainstream, quote, normal straight society, something he's again very conservative, he sees as a good thing. Is that a part of this that unsettles you, that those of you who can see yourselves as, you know, edgier, resent this kind of robbing you of what was almost a sort of an outsider status?
Yeah, I mean, I think questions about assimilation are definitely part of this debate, and people who want to say, we're just like everyone else, and we just want to be like you, and we want your families and your lives, and other people who say, no, we're different, and that's okay, and that's, you know, a part of what's great about this, and we want to preserve that difference. And also just bigger questions about, you know, what does the institution of marriage mean, and is it really something that I want to be a part of, and how well has it worked for straight people in the United States? And, you know, you look at things like divorce rates, you look at issues, you know, there's a lot of questions that it brings up for me about why is the state so invested in trying to keep us in these, you know, kind of romantic partnerships? Why is divorce so much more expensive than getting married? All these things are bigger questions for a lot of people in the community and for me. And so those are also parts of this question about, I don't necessarily just want to follow that path and continue along on this institution that has some problems with it that, you know, are important to me, and I want to question those and maybe try to do things differently because I have this opportunity.
Yeah, Miriam, no one's forcing you to get married. That's the same kind of argument that the religious right says, that if we allow gay marriages, then everyone will have to get gay married. You know, I think that we should, everyone in America should have access to the full rights of the Constitution, including equal protection. We shouldn't be arguing that as a community.
Well, I was going to say, Miriam, I'm wondering if this debate also reveals that the gay community isn't a monolith. You know, there are heterosexuals who eschew marriage as a confining patriarchal institution, but I guess, as Scott's saying, the difference is they have a choice.
Yeah, no, I know, I understand that, and I'm not arguing against gay marriage. There are some people who are against the movement at all, and I'm not one of those people, but I'm against it being the focus of all of the work of the LGBT organizations, and that's what we're really seeing, because a lot of the donors are those people who really only want to hear people talking about marriage, and that's really the issue that they care about, and they're really pushing that, and that's what, you know, frustrates me as an activist and someone who has a lot of issues that are really important to me, marriage not necessarily being my priority.
Well, Scott, by the way, how old are you?
32.
Well, it's a fascinating debate going on within the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, and now here. We really appreciate your having it with us. Scott Schmidt is a political columnist for SpotOn.com. Miriam Perez, a reproductive justice activist and editor at Feministing.com. And by the way, you can link to them at our website, here-now.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, staying with our romantic theme, tomorrow we'll hear how South Pacific is back on Broadway in a big way. That's tomorrow, back after the news. The world should be given a right to vote in the American presidential election, says a center-right newspaper in Brussels, because the decisions America makes affect the whole world. The British newspaper The Telegraph agrees, saying many Britons will feel it would be rather nice to have a vote, too. Well, we know this presidential election has seen historic levels of interest in the U.S., both in terms of press coverage and in the numbers who've gone to the polls, but Europeans have been following the election with great interest as well, taking sides and debating in cafes. Here to tell us what they're saying is Adi Raval, an American producer for BBC TV. And Adi, some parts of the press in Europe, others have said, seem to be swooning over Barack Obama. But you say overall, you see less cynicism in how the European press is covering this election. Why is that?
You don't see the kind of cynicism that you do, quite frankly, see in terms of the coverage of President Bush by European outlets. The European press, just like the American press, has been covering a president who has not been very popular on the European continent the last 7.5 years, and they are looking for a new kind of leader who has different positions on certain issues such as climate change and talking to Iran and doing more to deal with the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and what kind of new relationship will emerge between America and Europe.
Well, a German official is quoted as saying that Germany is Obama country and that Germans see him as a transforming figure like John F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King. The Washington Post sums it up by saying that Obama personifies, for many Europeans, not the America of Bush or Cheney, but the America that produced Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods. But candidate John McCain is also very popular in Israel and popular in parts of Europe as well.
Exactly. John McCain was treated very well by leaders there and by the public. And I think that is because he has come out in support of taking strong action against climate change. So it's not just about Obama. Both are being seen in a fairly positive way in Europe.
We should say it's not across the board in the media. The Times of London wrote, Obama has made only one brief official trip to London, none elsewhere in Western Europe. There's some worry as to what kind of, you know, foreign experience he has. Some people feel they don't know him as well as they might know John McCain, who's traveled pretty extensively. But I want to get back to that thought that was expressed in the Brussels newspaper that people should have the right to vote in the American election. It was also expressed in the London-based Daily Telegraph. A column there said maybe we shouldn't get the whole vote, but we would settle for 50% of votes cast by American citizens because it's nice to have even a marginal say in how the U.S. would choose to dispose our goodwill and our blood and treasure. It sounds as if many Europeans feel they have the right to have an impact on American elections.
Well, Robin, you're absolutely right. Both presidential candidates, Obama and McCain, realize that there's a great deal of money that can be raised overseas. That's one of the reasons why Senator McCain went on the European trip, and he also went to Iraq and elsewhere. But he did hold a huge fundraiser in London when he was there just a few weeks ago. And Senator Obama has made clear that he does plan a trip to the European continent, to London and to the Middle East in the coming weeks. And I'm sure that when he goes on this trip, he will see a lot of money coming his way in terms of private fundraisers held by Americans who are expatriates in places like Paris or in London or elsewhere.
You mentioned how some, not just world leaders and newspapers, but also citizens are responding positively to the campaign because they see in John McCain someone who's talking about global warming, or they see in Barack Obama someone who takes a stand against the war. But I'm wondering if there's a downside to that, because we're hearing some editorial pages worry that paradoxically, if governments like Germany, for instance, have what they perceive as a better friend in Obama, someone who was initially against the war in Iraq, then they might have to pony up support for helping out in Iraq. The Hamburg-based Die Welt is a paper that writes about that, that this could suddenly mean that the German chancellor would have a friendly but pushy partner in the White House who would ask for help for assistance in Baghdad.
Right. Current White House officials certainly don't expect any kind of military support from any European countries with reference to Iraq. Now, the key question is Afghanistan. What will happen in Afghanistan if McCain or Obama becomes president in terms of increased NATO support? The key point is we can't just look at Europe. We also have to look at what the Middle East is saying. And I must say, a lot of my friends in the Middle East were a little confused and a little dismayed by Senator Obama in a speech that he gave just a week ago at APEC, which is the Israeli Political Action Committee here in town in Washington. He said that he is in support of a united Jerusalem. And to some of my Palestinian friends especially, they thought that he meant that they should not have any kind of access or any kind of right to part of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. The Obama campaign quickly clarified their comment, but the original comment is clearly resonating within the Middle East in a not-so-positive way.
Speaking of Obama and paradoxes again, a left-leaning paper in Spain says that an Obama victory might rob the left of its campaign against America, because it will show that America is not the racist state that some in the left in Spain say it is. How much is Obama's race resonating in Britain, in other parts of Europe?
Quite a bit. I recall a quote from the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy in 1968, 40 years ago, where he said within 40 years he thinks a black man can be president just like his brother was. And that comment has been played out in the European press as well. They're fascinated by a man who is basically, in a lot of ways, in terms of his ethnic heritage, quite different than President Bush or other political leaders.
Well, what's been the reaction to the fact that John McCain is a Vietnam veteran and a much decorated one, a POW?
In reference to McCain, you think about Iraq. That's what the European press sort of sees in terms of his national security experience and in terms of his role in pushing forward the surge and things like that. So yes, they do admire the fact that this man is a Vietnam War hero, decorated one, but they also in the same breath think he's also the person who says that the war in Iraq should continue. Not open-ended, obviously, but that it should continue until the job is done.
Adi Raval, an American senior White House producer for BBC TV. Adi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just a quick reminder, you can listen to any of our programs stream live at our website, here-now.org. For past programs, you can click on the archives. You can always download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And tomorrow on Here and Now, with all the stories and statistics about absentee African-American dads, we'll hear the tale of one father who stood by his two sons, often with a belt and books in hand. That's tomorrow. Terrific story. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Game 3 for the Boston Celtics and Los Angeles Lakers tonight in L.A. The Celtics lead the series 2-0 in the best-of-7 NBA championship. But the Lakers are undefeated at home during the playoffs, while Boston has won just 2 of 7 postseason games on the road. When the Celtics take the floor at the Staples Center tonight, Boston fans scattered among the Hollywood crowd will no doubt shout the familiar "Beat L.A.," but on the Celtics bench, the players have a new rally cry. The word is Ubuntu. It comes from the Bantu languages of Southern Africa and loosely means, "I am because of you." Here and now's Martha Biebinger explains how it all came about.
The men in green chant Ubuntu in the locker rooms before games, wear it on practice T-shirts and wristbands, and refer to it when it really counts.
Certainly not the sight the Celtics and their fans want to see. Paul Pierce in a lot of pain.
While Pierce is carried off the floor in Game 1 of the finals, Celtics coach Doc Rivers calls the rest of the team together.
What did the guy from South Africa say about adversity? Nothing can get you down. That's why we play 12 guys. All right? Let's beat this team.
In our country, we've got something called Ubuntu, Ubuntu, Ubuntu.
This is Archbishop Desmond Tutu explaining the concept during a lecture to college students last year.
In our culture, there is no such thing as a solitary individual. I want you to be all you can be, because that's the only way I can be all I can be.
Coach Rivers adopted Ubuntu at the beginning of this season after a colleague suggested it, and Rivers read some of Tutu's work. Boston Globe sports writer Mark Spears says Rivers needed a way to unify a team with a lot of new players and 3 superstars.
It's given them something to become a unit, to become family, to put all their egos aside, and I think it's that mentality that has helped them get to where they are right now.
Not just the mentality. The word has become part of Celtics culture, says former Celtics forward and current commentator Cedric Maxwell.
Definitely in college right now. You'll hear one of them go, "Ubuntu, dog." So, and, you know, they joke about it, but they want to win.
Maxwell, who was the MVP when the Celtics won the NBA championship in 1981, says Ubuntu helps Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, and Paul Pierce focus on a common goal.
None of the big three last year, any one of those guys made the playoffs. So as players, sometimes they're like kids. I think they look for concepts. They look for themes that are going to bring them closer together.
While Ubuntu may be important to the team, most fans don't know it.
Have you heard of Ubuntu?
Of a what?
Ubuntu, the team slogan?
I have not.
No.
Who?
No.
No?
No. No, not at all.
Outside the garden before Sunday's near miss, I get 37 confused looks before I find Ed O'Neill and Suzanne Nevins from Connecticut.
I hadn't heard it, so he told me we were sitting at the bar. The Ubungo thing.
Ubungo, that means, oh, that's right.
Ubuntu.
Ubuntu, that means we're together, we're a team. That's what we're here for. It's not a one-on-one thing. It's not like, oh, we got the big Kobe guy. No, we got the big 3. No, we got the big 5. We got the big 12.
The Celtics aren't marketing Ubuntu. There is at least one unofficial T-shirt online that merges the old and new. Black and white hands clasped over a shamrock with Ubuntu in bold letters. Sports promoter Stephen Brown says it might be best to leave Ubuntu alone for now.
At least for this series, if it's a private moment, it shouldn't be commercialized.
At least, says Brown, until the Celtics give the okay. So for tonight, Celtics fans will stay with the well-known refrain, "Beat L.A."
To hear more from Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the meaning of Ubuntu, go to our website, here-now.org. And a quick note on a sports milestone.
And before Griffey Jr., his senior...
Cincinnati Reds outfielder Ken Griffey Jr. reached the coveted 600 home run mark last night with a first-inning blast that flew 413 feet into the right field seats at Dolphin Stadium in Miami. Griffey joins Barry Bonds, Hank Aaron, Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, and Sammy Sosa as the only players to reach this mark. But unlike Bonds, Griffey's name has never come up in baseball's steroids scandal, and unlike Sosa, he's never been caught using a doctored bat. Griffey was the youngest player in the majors, just 19, on April 10th, 1989, when he homered on the first pitch he saw at Seattle's Kingdome. Well, coming up, who says you can't go home again? More and more college grads are heading back to the nest and the welcoming arms of their parents. We'll explain why in 1 minute here and now. How to say this in a different way? We can't. We've run out. So simply put, the price of oil pushed higher today. Gasoline rose to a new record average of just over $4 a gallon. This after a report from the International Energy Agency that global demand will continue to rise, especially in China, where more fuel will be needed for reconstruction work after last May's earthquake. Well, record fuel prices, rising food prices, a tight labor market. Aren't you glad you're not just starting out in life? Oh, maybe you are. And maybe instead of heading out into the world, you're heading home. Economic factors might actually be changing the structure of American families. We remember the spate of hand-wringing stories from the 90s about 20-something slackers returning to the nest, moving back in with their overburdened parents. Well, a new crop of studies says that today parents are okay with kids reclaiming their rooms, and adult kids are increasingly doing just that. They're being called the boomerang generation, children of boomers who come back home after college. It's happening in the middle and upper class in the U.S. and also around the world, in Japan, Spain, and Italy, for different reasons. Dr. Catherine Newman is a Princeton University sociology professor. She's researched what's being called the boomerang generation. She joins us. And Dr. Newman, why are kids in this country increasingly moving back? We read 5% more than did so in 1980.
At the upper end of our class spectrum, they're moving back because it takes a long time and a lot of money to get the kind of education they need to launch themselves at the professional level that they aspire to. And what their families are doing is helping them shelter the costs of getting a master's degree or taking a job in a low-paying nonprofit organization in order to get experience and credentials that will help them launch at a higher level later on.
And you're saying that in most cases, and now we're sure there are still parents who are dreading the sight of, you know, the kid moving back in with all their laundry and everything, but in most cases, they're embracing kids moving back. And that has to do with this set of parents, one of the biggest sets of parents where each worked.
That's right. I should be clear that they embrace the return of their children as long as those kids look like they're on a pathway to it, a future that the parents approve of.
Not just on the couch.
Yeah, if they're sitting on the couch playing video games, that can lead to a lot of tension. But if they're out getting a master's degree or working at a low-paying job that has a better future in store, then it's a family decision to support that future. But as to why they're happy enough to see the young folks come back, I think it has to do with the length of time that mothers and fathers are spending in the workforce themselves during the time when their kids are young. They're spending many, many hours away from their families, and they're not sick of them when they turn 18. And they really miss them when they go away for college because they really haven't had nearly as much time with them as was true in an earlier generation of stay-at-home moms.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's just a closer relationship between boomer parents and their children.
Well, I'm wondering, too, then, how much of this is a part of helicoptering? You know, we heard about the helicopter parents who hovered around their kids when they went to school, these baby boomers who, you know, some say are overly protective of their kids. Is there some of that there, too?
Well, you know, the helicopter image is a pathological image, and I take objection to it because we have an overwhelmingly large young generation now, and as they try to squeeze into the tiny bottleneck of institutions that will really launch them into the upper middle class, it takes a tremendous amount of vigilance on the part of their parents to get them there. So we can make fun of them and suggest that they're somehow overly protective, but that disregards the nature of the competitive structure their kids are embedded in, even at the very young ages.
And I was asking if you thought Americans were coddling their young adults. You talk about in Italy, mothers don't want to let go of their 37-year-olds.
Yes. I was very surprised to discover that Italian mothers who, you know, were legendary for their interest in grandchildren actually never spoke about disappointment over their kids not having a next generation. You know, if your nest empties out, maybe you start worrying about whether or not you're going to have grandchildren. But if your nest doesn't empty at all, your role as a mother or a father actually hasn't come to an end. So instead, they talked about being somewhat fearful of what it would be like when their children left home. And frankly, even when the Italian younger people leave home, they often don't go very far. They often subdivide the family property, and they just move upstairs or they move next door.
And you say young people, they're not that young.
No, they're only young in the social sense that they haven't assumed these full adult responsibilities, but they're not young at all. 50% of Italian men age 30 have never left home. And that's why we have really sharply dropping fertility in Italy. If you don't leave home until after you're 30, if you have children at all, you're only going to have one.
Well, back to the U.S., do you also say that this is not as much a new phenomenon as, you know, going back to the way things used to be?
That's exactly right. Before World War II, it was absolutely common pretty much across the board for young people to stay home until they married, and they didn't marry until they were in their mid to late 20s before the 1940s. What happened after World War II was that we saw a real plummet in the age at which people married. They started marrying in their early 20s, and they left home accordingly. And now that's crept back up again. So it's kind of like a U-shape. We've returned back to a pattern that doesn't look all that different from what it looked like in the 1940s.
Well, and you found the current pattern of young people moving back in after college in other industrialized countries. We heard about Italy, but you say it happens in Japan and Spain. What are the reasons there?
The reasons are a little bit different there. For one thing, those people are not boomerang. They just don't leave at all because the universities in Italy and Spain and Japan tend not to build dormitories, and there's a very small, almost non-existent rental property sector in those countries. And so young people really can't afford to leave home. They stay home and they go to college wherever they grew up, as do many working class and poor Americans who are in college here. But it's also the case that they've been hammered in the labor market, as have our young people. It's much, much harder to find a good paying job for college-age people in those countries. The combination of those two things, weak labor market opportunities and high housing costs, more or less pushes them back into the family household. And it also delays the age of marriage. And that, in turn, is depressing fertility in those countries. So these are among the most Catholic countries of Western Europe. They had extremely high fertility rates until the last 20 years or so, and now they're way below replacement rate fertility, and that's because these delays in establishing new households are reshaping the family structure in those countries.
Well, as you say, again, in the U.S., some cultural attitudes are shifting. So if someone comes home to live with mom and dad, it might be because there's a plan and it's a kind of a lofty goal. But in Japan, it sounds like it's the opposite. These young people are called parasite singles, freechers.
That is a term. These are terms that were coined since the bubble burst in Japan, and we started to see the end of what was regarded as almost an entitlement in Japan of a lifetime job in the corporate structure. When those jobs disappeared, again, the possibilities for young people entering the labor market really hit the skids. And they started to react by defining the pathway their elders had taken of those lifetime jobs as perhaps not really what they wanted. And this was regarded by the older generation in Japan as a complete travesty. And they look upon young people as almost a defective generation. And they tend not to talk, as other countries might, about changes in the labor market or high housing prices. Instead, we see this highly moralistic language of blame, that this younger generation just isn't willing, it's selfish, it's unable to assume adult responsibilities, and sometimes the parents blame themselves for having produced a defective generation.
Well, I guess the take-home message from all of this, Dr. Catherine Newman, is if you're eyeing that room with the bunk beds and thinking what a lovely guest room it might be, maybe not yet. Maybe
I wouldn't pack up too fast.
Right. Dr. Catherine Newman, Princeton University sociology professor who's researched the trend of boomerangs, young people moving back in with their parents. Dr. Newman, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.